everybody. Welcome back to Second Act with me, Bonnie Somerville. Yes, I am back again. I know you've been counting the days to listen to this raspy voice coming at you from Long Beach, California. I hope everybody is good. Just a quick reminder, if you're not following me on Instagram, please do so at second_act_podcast. Leave me your messages, tell all your friends, send me some love that way. And my Instagram, which is Bonz with a Z, Somerville. And also download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave those reviews and those 5 stars because that matters. So I could keep bringing you these amazing guests. I'm so excited about this one. I'm actually really, really personally involved with this person. I've known him for well over a decade. I have worked with him twice. I have done a ton of charity work with him. He is one of the most charitable people you've ever heard of, and you'll find out more about that. That's a funny story about us hosting a charity event together that got really inappropriate, because when we get together, we are truly very inappropriate. He is an actor, a producer, a writer, a stand-up, a dad, a survivor, an advocate for sobriety, an amazing human being all around, and truly, truly, as big and bombastic as this man is, I've never met a kinder soul. The guy wouldn't say no to helping an ant cross the street at a picnic. I mean, he's that much of a good guy. So please enjoy this special interview with my good buddy, Tom Arnold. I'm very excited. I have one of my favorite people on this episode. I've known him for a very long time. He's one of the kindest, sweetest, funniest humans I've ever met. He's my good friend, Tom Arnold.
Hi, Bonnie. How are you?
How are you?
I'm well. I'm well. The kids are well. It's quiet. There were 3 skunks spotted next door.
That's exciting.
That is exciting. So I got to keep my eye on the dog. And because, you know, you get skunk on you. Ooh. You got to shave.
Ooh. And you're back in Los Angeles after shooting in Rome. I'm so jealous.
I am. Well,
what were you shooting?
It was called The Christmas Witch. You know, it was a sequel to Christmas Thieves. And
story had to be told.
We shot that in the fall. Michael Madsen and I went over there and shot this movie, and he was the elf and I was Santa. Quite a time. And then came back, and Michael had some issues with his passport. His ex-wife garnished it. And so he didn't make the flight. And then Billy Baldwin came in to play Uncle Tony instead of Uncle Vince. So he just blew my script.
Holy, that's a motley crew right there. Yeah.
But I loved it. You know, and I'd like to go back there after COVID single.
Yes.
Because I've never really traveled a lot single unless I was working. I could just tell. I could tell the vibe would be good.
Oh, really?
Go places when you're, you know you're going to, you know, when you go with somebody else, I guess in the best circumstances, it's wonderful. But if it's not the best circumstances, I think you're better off going by yourself. I could just tell. Uh-huh. You know, the first day, the director had me come up in a beautiful hotel, meet on the roof. And, I'm sure it's how it is for everybody over there. A lot of invitations to take me out.
Oh, really? Are they forward? Are they forward over there, those women?
I wouldn't call it forward. I'd call it excellent. And the director knew them because a lot of them were in the business. And I would say to him, now, have you slept with her? And he's like, yeah. I go, what about that one? No. Okay, that I want to talk to that one.
Oh, right. You
know, that's the weird guy thing. You're like,
it's kind of like being at Soho House. It's kind of like being at Soho House here.
It is, except it's Rome. And so everything is better. Everything is unbelievable.
It's sexier. It's
just beautiful. The history, just the way my driver drove like a maniac. But you know, it was the second when I went back in March, they had a code red lockdown. So the first time last fall, I walked around more because there was more people walking around and just people watching and going to different things that they did there. And it was, they were on code red when I went, after a week of filming. And so you basically went, your hotel had, they moved me to this other hotel, which was really beautiful. And it was like The Shining because I was like the only person there.
Yeah.
And so
I just did a job too that was at this beautiful hotel, the Fairmont in San Francisco, but it was really scary. It was empty. The halls are so huge. It's old. It's from the 1900s. And I said every day, I was like, this is creepy. Yeah. Like it's empty ghost town.
Yeah.
But wait, I want to tell everybody how we met so that because our history is we met on a TV show.
Yeah.
Yes. And it was yours. And it was a pitch for HBO from about your old best damn sports show. And we met on that. And then we did a pilot together.
Yep.
Everybody's what was that called? Somebody else's kids or I don't know.
I forgot.
Other people's kids. And you played my stepdad and Judith Light played your wife.
I love Judith Light. I'm still
an absolute legend.
I'm madly in love with her. So you.
And you and I immediately hit it off. And then we wanted to do the show together. And you've known me forever, but obviously you, as far as having a guest on the show to talk about second acts, I honestly don't know if there's anyone better than you.
Well,
how many acts do you think you've had? How many, like,
what? I don't, you know, I'm lucky to be alive. I think that you have, there's probably three acts. And what is
growing up in Iowa was number one. I was going to ask about that. And then town boy.
Right. Working at the meat packing plant for 3 years out of high school on the kill floor. Tried to save money to go to the University of Iowa, basically, because I just felt, well, if I get there, then I can do anything. Anything in the world is possible. And I had a lot of dreams, and they've all come true. I'm going to be honest with you.
Really?
Get a dream bigger. But no, I had a lot of dreams. And you know, right now there's a documentary series about my sister that I participated in called the Queen of Meth on Discovery Plus. And you get a good idea how we grew up. You know, they go back and kind of chronicle our lives, you know. She's my younger sister by a year, and she became a massive methamphetamine distribution and producer and drug, you know, with the biker.
Did you know this was happening? Because I've heard you talk about this with Stern. Like, did you know she was doing that?
Well,
she was like a kingpin.
My sister was a drug dealer. I knew that. And before I stopped using drugs, that wasn't the worst thing in the world to have your sister who could get any drug at any time. My friends and I love my sister. But I was, because she, you know, her life just changed dramatically when she was 14. I'd moved. Our dad raised us. And when I was 10, he married the next door neighbor. She wasn't a fan of mine. And when I was 15, I moved in with our mom, our crazy, crazy mom. And I knew our mom wasn't a mom, you know. I just knew. When she left, when I was four, I knew that. I was like, this is not a mom. This is not anything like, my sister, I moved in so I could drink and do drugs and they have no rules.
Your mom, was she like a pal? Did she hang with you guys and do that with you?
Me. I wouldn't hang with her. But she was with my sister.
Oh, okay.
So my sister, when she was 14, she followed me over there. And my sister didn't have the luxury of knowing, oh, you know, she's a maniac. You know, she was married 7 times, our small town, alcohol, like all this stuff. And my sister, because my dad didn't do something. Here's something I do with my kids. Because, you know, I've had some issues with their mother and custody and different things and police and ridiculous things. And now what I do is if she does something that's highly inappropriate in front of them, if she acts, you know, I'll take a second and go, hey, what you just saw, I would not treat her like that. I would not like you guys to treat anybody like that. And it wasn't okay. I just want you to know, that wasn't okay. And then
that's
we move
so
on.
Great. That you is know, so I, great to acknowledge it, because that's one of my things. I always say, you know, all the craziness I grew up with, one of the biggest issues is that people just not acknowledging it, not recognizing it, not validating it. And sometimes you just need someone to go, I saw what just happened. It's not okay.
I was there. You were, and my dad never did that. He just laughed it off. I think he was grateful he had his kids. And my mom would come over just out of control, wasted, crazy. And my dad would just laugh. And so I knew that my mom was not. I mean, she made it clear early when she's like, hey, I'm not maternal. I'm not going to tell you I love you, but I will tap you on the knee once in a while. I was like, okay, great.
Oh my gosh.
But my sister worshiped her. So my sister didn't have a sense of reality because of, like you just said, no one ever said, hey, what just happened was not okay. And when she moved in with our, me and my mom and my sixth of seven stepfathers, they were best friends. They were best bar friends. They partied. The first drug she ever did was with our mom. Up till then, my sister had been an A student and done a great athlete and done all these things. But as soon as she gets in with mom, then they're bar people. I mean, they had pictures taken together, which is so creepy, where they go out to the mall and come on. Wow. I wanted to do those pictures, I'll tell you that. And they went out, and my sister started dating a 23-year-old guy. She's 14, you know, a rapist and a serial pedophile. And my mom and Kenny,
yeah,
they told her, you could break up with him or we'll have him arrested, or you could marry him. And, you know, you're 14 and you're real stupid. And she's like, oh, well, I'll marry him. So my mom drove them to Missouri and married. Yeah. And that really was the end of my sister's, for sure, childhood. But her life just went on a cliff, because this guy, I remember my mom came home without her. And you know, I was so pissed. I mean, I tried to stop them when I heard that was going on for my stepdad. I tried to get on the highway and called my dad and said, we got to try to, I know they're going to Missouri. I don't know if it's Lancaster or wherever they're going. And my mom just came home that night. She was so drunk and she was sad, crying, whatever her bullshit is. And I said, where's Lori? And said, well, she's at her apartment. In other words, her life, she's with that guy, and that guy beat her up. And eventually I had to go take Lori out of there. That guy, who was 23, he'd already divorced a 15-year-old.
Oh my sister got involved. Are you kidding? Is this is insane?
Yeah.
I mean, I know some of your stories. I never heard this one.
No, this is, and he cheated with a 12-year-old.
Oh my, is he in jail or dead?
Yeah, he did. He died of a serious fire in his own bed.
wow, that sounds too good for him.
But they, then she was in the life, because she couldn't really go back to school. And they talk about how it felt to her friends who were walking to school with her. They all said she's living in an apartment, and there's an innocence you have when you're younger, where you get to really take advantage of going to school and do this, get a little trouble, do this. And now since she was a married woman, so when you try to come back from that, there's no place for you. She tried to come back to school. It just didn't work out. And then she ends up, you know, she got into the prostitution business and then the drug business. And then she met a guy and married him. She was 18. He was like 38. This president of the Grim Reaper motorcycle gang. And so they already were into drugs and distribution and stuff. And she figured she was so poor too. She was living out on the river. And by the way, there's a difference between river people and lake people.
Is this like living in a van down by the river?
It's just rivers just go. The Des Moines River.
That's like the sketch on SNL.
Bodies and whatever. And she said, well, I'm going to do this business, but I want to be really good at it. And I'm going to build it up. And then she just, you know, I mean, I knew it was, you know, there were things like my mom was like, Lori bought me a new living room set. I'd be like, yeah, Lori's a drug dealer. Yeah, she goes, but it's amazing. You know, my dad always stuck his head in the sand about it. But I knew she was doing it. You know, we are the other kids in my family. We were all, you know, I was concerned about it because I didn't like the bed that she chose. We had a few things about that, but I knew she was doing that. At the same time, I'm dreaming to get out of Iowa and become a stand-up comedian.
So you wanted to be a stand-up comedian that young? Was that your number one dream?
I mean, that was like the dream in my head, because our dad, the only time we really heard him laugh would be when there was a Bob Hope special on. Remember, Bob Hope used to have these big specials. And I just said to my brother and sister, whatever it is that Bob Hope does, that's what I want to do. And
were you funny then? Did you like?
Well, I was funny and brave. You know,
sounds like you're brave.
Well, you know, there's a lot in a meatpacking town like ours. There's a lot of bullies, and they're the older kids on your street. You know, you have to walk a freaking gauntlet to get to school, and eventually, I realized, maybe if I made these guys laugh, they wouldn't beat the shit out of me. And then eventually I realized, oh, I'm bigger than them. I'm going to beat the shit out of all them.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Okay, here's something that you maybe don't know about me, but if you know me, then you do know this. I do not relax well. I don't sleep well. With my crazy life, it's just hard for me, and my crazy brain, it's just hard for me to shut it off and chill. I overthink, I stress out, I don't sleep, and you know what? It sucks. So I did my homework, and I found Sunday Scaries, which are delicious, and vitamin-boosted CBD gummies. They are like a must-have now for me on the daily. They chill me out just about 20 minutes. Basically, they take the edge off so I can just like chill out and live scare-free. So there's no risk to buy. The company offers 100% lifetime money-back guarantee. If the product is not for you, that's okay. You'll get your money back. Sunday Scaries, you know, in the stress-relieving business, not in the stress-causing business. So I got you 25% off to prove it. Visit sundayscaries.com. Use my promo code BELIEV, that's BLEAV, for your discount. That's promo code BLEAV for 25% off at sundayscaries.com. They're effing amazing. And you know what? You won't regret it. And you might get a good night's sleep. That's such a funny part of your story that you worked in the meatpacking on the kill floor. I mean, that's like, to go from that to what you've done, I mean, like, it's just it's so much. It's so opposite.
Yeah.
So then did you get into school? Did you save money and then you went to school?
Yeah. And I have to say this about Bob Hope.
Yes.
You know, you talk about dreams coming true. One of the first things I did when I moved to Los Angeles was a Bob Hope special. And Bob Hope called my dad and he wrote stuff. And so my dad watched, who used to watch Bob Hope in our living room, in the same living room, years later, he watched me and Bob Hope on the same TV. And so that's like, that's magic.
Yeah.
And you know, I've talked about the magic of what our business is and life. But I also thought, well, now what? I've done the Bob Hope special. And I think part of me was like, if I could just be on TV once, the people in my town would really like me. And that just turns out not to be the case.
When did you go? Wait, tell me, did you graduate school or did you finish or did you quit?
I because I was working at the meatpacking plant, I started school in Ottumwa at the community college, Indian Hills Community College, which is really the biggest life changer for me, because then you went from a guy that works at a meatpacking plant to a guy that's going to college and working at a meatpacking plant. And then I went to Iowa. I did 2 years there, 2 years in Iowa. And Iowa City just opened up because there was people that didn't look like me. There were smart people. They from all over the world, it seemed like. And it was just like this new
blew your mind
possibilities. You know, I'd get on stage in the student union.
So what was your first? That's tell me the very first time you got on stage ever. When was it?
It was at the student union at the Wheel Room, it was called, the University of Iowa. I think it probably still is. And, you know, all my friends came. And we drank Everclear Punch, which is straight up Everclear and powdered Gatorade. So everybody came. My Uncle Bob came and filmed it. And I thought, man, I am so funny. I'm going to be on Letterman in like a month. That's when Letterman was first started. And it took me like 8 years to get on Letterman. But I, you know, I learned a lot, too. And then the people that had performed, the real comics that came from Minneapolis, you know, I was a student comic. Because my friends all left when I got done opening up, and the guy that booked this once a month show down there said, listen, if you get your friends to stay for the real comics, then I'll give you a job in Minneapolis as a comic. And I was like, oh, hell yeah, we'll do that. And so after my fourth year, and I still had a little to go to get my degree because not everything transferred. But after my fourth year, I just got on a bus. I had $100, took it to Minneapolis, got off the bus at the Comedy Cabaret and said, hey, I'm here and I got a trash bag full of clothes and I don't have anywhere to live or a car. So when I do find a place, it's got to be very close to the club. And he's like, why? I go, because I'm working here now. And he's like, no, what I meant was one weekend for $17.
But is that like, that is such a great story for people to hear, because sometimes you have to literally have the balls to do something like that and be like, no, 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 I'm working here now.
Yeah.
That's such an awesome story. And
you have to be crazy too, because it doesn't make sense, especially where I grew up. It doesn't make sense, but you just have to believe that there's something else out there. That's really the difference between my sister and I. It's not like I was smarter or I just had this dream. And during my third year at the plant, because my grandpa had worked there 50 years. And my dad worked there, and then you start going, well, this is a damn good job. I got benefits and things. And, and I started thinking, well, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe there is no way to get out of here, because it doesn't make sense. Like, how do you get from here to Hollywood? And one night went out after work, and we had a disco called the Jailhouse. It's like an Iowa redneck disco, which my parents eventually ruined by going there with their fucking line dancing buddies. But I walked out and I saw Andy Kaufman on the street, like in Ottumwa, Iowa. And he was talking to people. I'm like, holy shit. You know, he was on Taxi. He's a brilliant comic. And I said, how did you get here? And he said, well, you know, you had a women's wrestling event at the Coliseum. And I went, and then I paid them to stay later and wrestle me to train me. And then I took everybody on buses to Happy Joe's Pizza. And I was like, that is my goal, to be able to take everybody to Happy Joe's Pizza. And then it got a little crowded. He ran off, but I realized, oh shit, it is humanly possible to get from there to here. So it's gotta be, there's whatever that tube is, it goes both ways. And so it was quite inspiring.
You manifested it though. Like
I mean, there's a lot of that. And, you know, he was staying in Fairfield at the Maharishi International University working on transcendental meditation. And a lot of people, you know, if you really look around your opportunity, you have more opportunities than you think you do. And so people from all over the world were coming there because of that. At that time in my town, they called them the Roos, the people live there, the gurus. And, you know, you're farming. But if you want to do something, you look around, well, what options do I have? And how am I not going to hurt myself getting those options? And I did hurt myself a lot because, you know, I've been arrested more than my sister, you know, for fighting and drunk driving and fighting with police. And I remember one time specifically, I was in the back of a squad car and I was handcuffed behind my back. And I thought, I have got to get it together, because if I do get it together, there is something out there. There is always a voice. And so then I got out of there. I mean, a sane person wouldn't have quit school and showed up with a trash bag on a bus, but I loved it so much. I love stand-up comedy so much that I just didn't care. I mean, it was fun, and it certainly beat my other life. And, you know, you work for nothing. And Minneapolis had 5 comedy clubs back then. This is 1983. And so you got to do those, and then you got to travel a little bit. And then I met Roseanne when I first moved there. She was a comic out of Denver, and she wasn't the, you know, Roseanne yet.
Right.
And we worked together and we hit it off like you and I.
Yeah.
Because I knew how funny she was. And she said I was funny too, which, you know, men know we're good looking, but if a woman thinks we're funny.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, no, but no, women too. I mean, men can say, oh, you're pretty, but when a guy says, and she's funny, that like, it's like, that is just, you know, cause well, how many female comics, especially back then, were there?
Yeah, that's true.
Famous, none. True. It was a man's world.
Yeah. Well, and you are very funny, buddy. Well, if you weren't funny.
What? No. Oh, I would be dead.
It's such a big thing, though.
I would be dead. My mom's favorite story is that when I was a kid, I'd be in the worst trouble. And she goes, and this little kid would fucking say something and make me laugh. And I'd be little and go, I see it. I see you. I see it. Yeah. And she goes, I would say, your eyes are crinkling. Your eyes are crinkling. And she'd start laughing. And she said, you got out of everything. I kind of did get out of a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Not recently, recently I had a little trouble. But
take a moment. I just remembered a couple of funny things.
Take a moment of this, you know, talking about second act.
You are genuinely one of the funniest humans I've ever met. And then us together.
That means so much to me, coming from you.
You know, and the things that we've hosted together.
Oh, God.
Because you're also, it can be crazy. Inappropriate in the funniest ways. And we have stuff where...
Let's tell that story about... We hosted a charity event together for domestic violence, which I'm open about. You know, I grew up with that, and that's very important to me. And Tom never says no. People listening have to know. The man doesn't say no to any charity work. Honestly, like, you could ask Tom the day before to do something for kids or women, and he's like, great, I'll be there. And he actually...
You could ask me.
Well, okay, because I'm funny. Yeah. And pretty. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. But you will show up for anything. Anyway, I hosted this domestic violence charity with you that you actually brought me into the previous year. And we're up there and nobody's bidding. It is the coldest, quietest. I mean, like a millionaire plastic surgeons and their wives, and it's dead. And I'm dying. And we tell them.
Because the plastic surgeons fix the women who had this horrible scars.
Yeah, it's free surgery for victims giving them free surgery. Yeah. And we just start trying to, you know, we're just winging it. And what did we say?
And all of a sudden we start beating each other, like, you know, pretending that we're fist
pretending to box. We start pretending to box on stage. And,
it looked really bad.
Like, it looked so bad. And we were dying.
Like, oh, God. Oh, and dude, you look at the front row, there's these poor women.
Oh, God. They're disfigured.
And it was just so inappropriate. But people bid.
It was funny.
I know. And I thought, that's just something forever that I have, Bonnie and I have. What just happened? Because it was a very nice event, too. People were dressed up. You know, there was some
black tie, fancy
knobs there. And then to end up, who else would go with that? It's a bit in a domestic.
I don't know. And then we were joking about beating each other up and maybe how much to see me punch Tom Arnold. And then you're like, and then you go, wait, I don't think we should go with this line of jokes.
But that's life, man. That's such a good thing to be able to laugh.
The best thing about comedy, which I don't know how you feel about right now, what's going on with the whole cancel culture and stuff, especially for what you do. It's just the comedy. I mean, without comedy, I wouldn't have gotten through my childhood. Yeah. Making myself laugh and dreaming of being an actress and being fun, like that got me through.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I think that if you do, if you do something atrocious or some kind of horrible Me Too thing or something racist, you're not being canceled, you're just being fired.
Right.
And so to call that, people really have the right wing, the far right has really taken the cancel culture to use as, you know, we can't do now, we can't overturn the free and fair election. What is the world coming to? But you do, I mean, there are mistakes with our culture, and there's mistakes made as we figure out how to be better, all of us.
All of us are constantly making mistakes. And I mean, that's life.
But if it's not thing, you know, because you know, there's a lot of male comics, and it ain't it hard for women to work.
Yeah, that stuff I'm on board with. But I'm talking about, you know, that just someone brings up a tweet that someone tweeted. And when you were coming up in the business and half the things people said, then they would be canceled for now.
Well, my brother has a picture of me kissing a dog's asshole and for money. And then
can I use that as the promo for this episode?
Yeah. Well, also, you know, I had four best friends and one of them passed out, and we took pictures of this. This may be like, I'd probably go to prison, of my scrotum on his face. He said, that's Brownie. He's still one of my best friends in the world.
Yeah, but see, what's wrong with that? That just sounds normal, you know?
Yeah.
What's up?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think when people criticize, you know, I have been pretty politically active, and I don't really consider politically active. I think it doing the right thing for truth and justice. But I don't care what people say about my tweets. I got in a couple times in trouble on Twitter with Twitter briefly, but people are trying to throw me off Twitter all the time. They file the place, they say, well, why can Tom Arnold be on here when Donald Trump can't be on here? And it's because I'm not a maniac. And I'm also a comic. So I walk a fine line. I've got over it a few times.
I like when you kept telling people on Twitter that, you know, come here, come say that to my face.
Yeah.
You know, to the Trumpies. You would say, and I'd be like, Tom, are you okay? And you would text back, I don't care.
And I think you got to know this too. The people on the internet, they aren't real. You know, I know that I see my kids with the way they deal with video games and YouTube and TikTok. And I have to remind them, you know, if you're going to get your feelings hurt doing this, you can't do this, because you shouldn't be on social media if you get your feelings hurt. And everybody has feelings and stuff, but these people really, a lot of them don't even exist. In your head, they exist, and then you give life to that. And I have some fun with the negative ones, because if you're a comic, you kind of, you know, but I think that, and I'm sure there were times when I was more sensitive, but at a certain point, you just got to blow by, because otherwise you'll miss all the great people. You'll miss all the positive things that people do to you and say to you and support you. And, you know, sometimes you got to stick your neck out, and you're always a person that's willing to stick their neck out. And so, you know, and you also,
especially for some people I love, I will, but I've recently, you know, sometimes Dave has to tell me, like, do not reply to this person, you know, and because I'm always ready for a fight, you know, that's how I grew up. And he's like, don't, why are you replying? And it's true. I always tell people, you can't be an actor if you get your feelings hurt. Like, cause we get rejected for a living. That's what I, you know, when I work, that's a vacation basically. But sometimes I want to reply so bad, but I'm, you know, but I'm not a comic, and you guys can.
But you're funny. You're funny. I think also, you know, we both worked in really toxic environments here and there where people that had more power. I'm not talking about Roseanne, because I was a boss there, but people that have more power, and I think especially to women, it just, you know, there was, and it's changing. That's a good thing about cancel culture, or whatever you call it, the legitimate one, is you just can't be an asshole to everybody.
Right.
And you can't threaten women, and you can't, you know, I see this Joss Whedon thing, the guy from, and his first job was working with me on the Roseanne show in the writer's room. And I remember he had long, red, flowy hair. And I was like, I'm going to punish this guy every day, because he's the new kid writer. And, you know, he's very talented. And I had to check into Van Nuys Psych for 4 days. I'm doing way too much drugs. And they gave
which act was that one?
Yeah, no, she did. They gave me a thing, a psychological profile to fill out, which was just this thick. And I took it into the writer's room. I go, we'd fill this fucking thing out. He goes, what? I go, I'm going to kick your ass. You don't fill this out. And he probably still has it. Now I'm thinking that me being mean to him turned him into an asshole, but that's just not true.
Well, you
that's
certainly didn't true. Make him do what he did to those.
No, that's girls, just not true. And people just, so there's a lot of good things about cancel culture. I don't, but the people on Fox News whine about it. And so we, you know, they've taken it, they've kidnapped the term, some people need to be canceled.
I agree. Exactly. There's levels, but I just was wondering, because as a comic, it's so difficult now to make jokes that we used to make or that you used to make. You know what I mean? I don't know. Like,
well, we can't beat up each other up at a domestic abuse fundraiser. It's not difficult. You just have to be funny. You have to work on material. And there's a lot of really funny people out there, and really funny women now. And really funny, because it's getting into stand-up comedy. That's another reason I respected Roseanne so much, was here she is going up against, I saw her go get into it with audiences, with men, and hold her own and better. And I said, well, that's as sexy as you get there. But I think that there's.
And brave. Oh, God.
We're back to doing stand-up comedy. And I certainly don't feel. You know, I felt for a long time the political part of it, because, you know, there were so many Trump supporters that are comedy patrons, and they just thought I was being so mean to Donald Trump, not even in my act, but just in my personal life. And they do death threats to all the clubs, and they do whatever. And, you know, again, those aren't real, but they affect, you know, they affect the bookers. They're like, hey, we don't want to have an onslaught of fucking trolls, on our Facebook page for Clusterfucks Comedy Club or whatever. But
so outspoken about Trump. I think we all know that. I mean, you were single-handedly, you were going to bring that guy down. I mean,
he's down. And, I also had the opportunity, because you stand up, you speak your truth or whatever. And there's also a lot of Trump supporters in our business. a lot of people that want to make money anyway, and felt like, well, this is the guy. So, and all of them were producers, Mark Burnett, who I had to fight with. But I think that, you know, if you do the right thing, good things are going to happen. Maybe not today. And I got to know a lot of people like the Pool Boys, the Jerry Falwell, because Jerry Falwell was the target of mine too, because I was like, how does he end up with Trump? And then the fact that I got Michael Cohen, a lot of tape with Michael Cohen and I talking, explaining about this, fixing this deal with the Pool Boy and allegedly having these pictures, and then seeing the pictures, they weren't what Michael Cohen was saying either, and going, that's how he got Trump to support him. Michael Cohen fixed this Pool Boy thing, and then he came back and said, hey, I've still got a picture of Becky, and I need you to support Trump. And it was just that, you know, because it didn't make any sense that a religious person like that would support Trump, because Trump is a monster. And so, you know, getting to know these young men, and there's a bunch, but these young men who were in these psychologically abusive relationships with Becky and Jerry Falwell. And just Jerry Falwell would say, and he said to Giancarlo Granda, who was the first, he hates being called a pool boy, but he said, I have a tape of you having sex with my wife, and I'm going to send it to your girlfriend if you do one more thing. And, you know, and the fun thing about people like Jerry Falwell is they want to get caught. You know, they want to, you know, he's an alcoholic. He's a practicing alcoholic. He is being very inappropriate with students, him and his wife. And he's also a coward who blamed his wife, you know, and then we had to prove that it wasn't just the wife and right. These guys, Jerry was there. And, you know, I think that there's a, you know, I didn't like him, but you can probably hear the taste of me talking about this with Michael Cohen, is because he hated Muslims and he loved guns and hated immigrants. And then his wife and him are fucking a guy named Giancarlo Granda, who's half Mexican. And so
you can't even make this shit up.
Yeah. I was like, well, this is a hypocrite who just wants to, you know, take advantage of the tax breaks. And it was led to his downfall. He got fired from the university last September. You know, Giancarlo was very instrumental in that because he had to show them, you know, that these guys, the one thing they don't want is to be like gay. Well, that seems.
Yeah,
my wife, you'll throw their wife under the bus, but they don't want to be part of whatever that thing is. And the same with the pool boys. They don't want to be. They're like, no, he did. I was with Becky and he was with Jerry. Like, they're funny, like young guys. First of all, if you're a young guy and you work at the Fountain Blue Hotel, you're a pool attendant, whatever. And this rich couple comes in there. And Becky's attractive, you know, and says, hey, would you come and party with us in the hotel? And my wife wants to have sex with you. You know, if I was 19 or 20, I'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm in.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And that's how they, you know, then they're like, well, we're going to make your dreams come true, too. What's your dream? And he's like, well, I'd like to open up a youth hostel here in Miami. We'll be your partner. Here's $4 million.
Oh, my God.
And so, you know, go down a private jet and fly around. He tried to get away from that, and then they would do these crazy things to lure him in. They got to know his parents. They became – and if you're a parent and you're a born-again Christian and your son is friends with Jerry and Becky Falwell who are like God, you're like, whoa, don't ruin that thing. So you really need to be honest with your parent. If you can imagine not being able to be honest with your mother who you're very close to, you know, I think that – so anyway, so that stuff – this Trump stuff with Trump led to all this because everyone around him was also so bad. And so
when you took on that, when you were going, cause I, you know, you'd go on CNN when you were doing all that and you were so outspoken and, you know, you were like, did you care at all about your career? Like, did you just not care what people think or thought or worry or say?
I knew it was so bad. I knew because I know Trump 38 years, whatever. And had spent time with him and been in Playboy Mansion with him but also done business with him. I knew he was the worst person in the world. Like people, and I knew how racist, and I knew how the misogyny, and I just knew he would do anything or say anything. And he didn't care about the country. He didn't care about anybody. And so all these enablers of his, you know, these Republican enablers, like, yeah, he's our guy. Oh, his policies, that one thing he did, you know, the xenophobia or the anti-Semitism. I'm not for that one thing, but I'm for this other thing. And people just enabled him. And then he's tried to destroy the country. He literally tried to overturn a free and fair election. It's never happened in history. He incited a mob of his supporters to go in and try to murder his vice president. And if they'd have got through that last chain of cops, they would have murdered people. And that's why. And just the fact that these cops were so brave, and just you could see the videos of them just hand to hand combat with these people, and the Republicans do not want to know the truth about that day, because the truth about that day they feel will hurt them, because it will reflect on Donald Trump, who right. did nothing, who sat the most powerful man in the world sat there, watched it on TV, and did nothing. So
yeah, it's pretty crazy.
I feel that anybody, there were people that have problems with me speaking out, but that's on them.
But you didn't care at all. You were like, I don't care. Because, you know, that whole thing, actors should shut up, you know, just perform. I mean, we get that all the time. Actors shouldn't be political. Like, you just, you're so passionate about everything. You really, truly don't care.
Well, I care about my kids. Again, they're 8 and 5. And what's the best thing I can do for them is to speak up about all the injustice, especially when I know somebody and I spent time with them. It's really on me to speak up. And you know, it costs you money, it costs you whatever, but at the end, you're yourself, and you've done what you believe in. And it's turned out to be everything I said to be true. And
that is true. But can I ask you a question? Because you live your life like that, like as far as all the things you've been through, and you're so open about it. Is that like kind of your mantra? Like if you speak up and you're a good person, it doesn't matter. Like right. if you fall down and whatever you do, because you talk right, about your struggles openly.
Yeah. And if you do the right thing, if you're of service to other people, if you do the right thing, it doesn't matter, because you end, whether some people call it God, I'm going to call it God. You are rewarded, because it changes everything for everybody. If you're negative and you put, you know, if you're just a little slippery, like my sister is a full on gangster and criminal, and you know, and there's some people like Trump and those guys that are always working the margins and sometimes go out here and just live their life dishonestly. And for me, that doesn't work, because that's the way I end up dead from drugs or alcohol or, you know. And so we have this life, and every day we have an opportunity. We make mistakes. We get back up. We acknowledge our mistakes, and then we move on. And acknowledging all my mistakes has been, number one, good for me, and trying to make amends and not having resentments by dealing with stuff, because it's kept me alive and sober. And you know, there's tough days though. And I want to say tomorrow it could be off the rails, but I'm aware of that. And so, you know, when you share things, when you have something happen and you share it and you share your embarrassment or your pain or your whatever, it affects other people, because they see that and they connect to it in a way that movies and TV can't.
Absolutely. You know? I that's why when I started this podcast, it was all about, you know, all the times I've fallen down and I just hit, you know, bad times. And I get messages from people that are just so like, God, it really inspired me. And that's the only reason why I wanted to do it. Cause if you have someone to look up to or say, well, I thought her life was perfect, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, I just had a huge mistake happen. And it's like the support of knowing that everybody, just being honest about it, acknowledging it and getting support from people. It's just like, oh God, it makes you get up again. It makes you go, today's a new day.
Right. And it is a new day. And you know, but it's also saying, oh, that's a sign, or, okay, that's not going to happen again. That's yeah. just, you know, as we were chatting, I think that's really important. That's really important. Instead of living in the shame. There's a lot of people that want to shame you all the time. You know, I feel that with people that want me to be Tom Arnold on my worst fucking day. And that's not who I am. And that's not who I am, you know, 30 years ago. That's just not who I am. And so people that want to keep you in that shame, you got to get them the fuck out of your life. You got to not, because you can't live in that if you want to be better.
Amen.
You know? And so my first half was in Iowa, getting out of Iowa, and then coming out here and being a comic and a writer. So I got three halves. I got their thirds. But then was becoming a parent. So, I mean, I look at, you know, I mean, I always said I wanted to be a parent, and it turned out I really did want to be a parent, thank God. Because, you know, I'm 62, single dad. I got an 8-year-old son and a 5-year-old daughter. And it is, you know, you talk about unconditional love. And but you say that at weddings. I've said it 4 times and had it said to me. But there's conditions. There's conditions, right? You know, but these kids, man, from the moment you meet them, the moment they come out of wherever, it was a C-section, so come out, you go, oh, that kid loves me unconditionally. And I love this kid unconditionally. And that kid is going to look to me every moment of their life. So I got to have my shit really together. And I also can't go, oh, boo-hoo, I've never been unconditionally loved by a woman or family. I go, oh, no, I can't say it anymore.
Because it's not about you anymore.
They love you so much, you know. And,
do you think has that been the number one reason, like you've, you know, your sobriety, everything that you've worked for? I mean, now it's like all about them, right? Everything. Yeah.
It is
all about them.
It is a little shocking too to go, nothing is about you from this point on. And I feel good that I've done so many things though, because, you know, I think when people have children early, when I was 18, my 17-year-old girlfriend said she was pregnant, and I was like, okay, I'm going to be at Hormel forever. And then I drove down to Missouri to tell her dad, who was a great big 6'8" farmer who wanted to murder me. And then it turned out she was lying. Thank God.
That never works, ladies, it never works.
Yeah, my life would have been just that.
Yeah.
And so I thought it's a gift from God right here. I've got another chance. Because at that time I was like just roping it all in, like, right, but working the meatpack plant, there's a lot of people that are happy there. And they're happy because they have families to support, or you know.
Yeah, my whole neighborhood never left. Everyone from Brooklyn, I was like, I gotta get out of here. You know, it's like they were happy there. That's what they wanted.
Brooklyn's where you move to.
Well,
it's right in Iowa.
Now you do, but yeah. not when I was a kid.
No.
But yeah, like you were so you're the one that when we had dinner with the doctor, you were the one when I turned 40 and like my whole life was falling apart. And we had dinner with the doctor from that charity event that won the auction to go to Soho House with you and me for dinner. And yeah, you were so like, why haven't you frozen your eggs? And I was like, well, I don't want to do it alone because I was raised. And you were like, Bonnie, you like, and the doctor, because of you, said, yeah, I'll do it for free.
Yeah.
He said, I'll do it for free because of what you do with these women. And that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for you.
Well, I think too, Bonnie, you know, you're just such a good person. You had a great role model with your mother. I think that if you want to have kids, you just do that. And then you give them your life, and you don't go, well, I got to be with this guy, or have to have this perfect thing or whatever. Cause you're like me, you tried to find that and you have it now. Although
I do. I have it now. I hope I keep this one because I never thought it was going to happen to me. I was like, I had given up. I said, I'm never getting engaged. It's too late. Yeah. I'm just who I am. I'm just, you know, I can't find anyone. No one gets me. And it did happen for me, like at 46.
Yeah,
so it's never too late.
Yeah. And he seems like a guy that's not so much like you that it's not going to work out. And that's kind of,
thank God he's not like me.
You know, but he's, you know, I saw him watching you just with love on his face. You got to have someone that's just thick or thin. They got your back and solid. He's a solid dude. Yeah.
But you know what? If I had met him in my 30s or earlier, I would have blown it 100%. I was a late bloomer. I wasn't ready. I had a lot of work to do, did a lot of therapy. Like for me, my journey, I would have blown it. Totally would have blown it.
Well, you still have a chance. No, I'm teasing. But no, in a great place because I have known you in the middle of the therapy, yeah, like the middle of just the anxiety because of the trauma and abuse that you've gone through. With everything, you're like this, and I get that. Believe me.
And you're always somebody I've always looked up to because you are so supportive of and so like, come on, get up, do this. Why can't you do it? Why can't you do it? Why can't you do it? And that's who you are. And I just think like you've lived your life like that since getting out of the meat plant. Like, nope, come on, I'm gonna do it with everything against you that you've had: family, abuse, drugs, you know, Roseanne, yeah. I'm just kidding. You are really such a positive person. Yeah. You really are like, nope, going to start over.
Right. Well, it helps to be that a little crazy, I call it. Like to believe the stuff that we've made come true is insane.
I was told this is never going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I dropped out of school. I was like, you know, cut off. It was like, this is never going to happen my whole life. And I was like, no, it is. But it is insane that I did it because I never had any, there was no acting. I mean, in my world where I grew up, I mean, are you kidding? But it is, you have to be a little crazy. You have to.
You know, and I see people like Julie Brown, Julie K. Brown is what she goes by, the journalist. She was with the Miami Herald when I met her. She broke the Epstein story. And she was also helpful with the Jerry Falwell stuff. You know, I called her up one day and I said, I want to help you with the Epstein stuff. Here's some information I have. I know Ms. Maxwell. And she goes, well, is this for a show, this conversation? I go, no, I don't have a show. It's never been about my show. And this woman, you know, she grew up in Philadelphia. And she was a single mom who was on welfare and just is killing it. She's a Pulitzer Prize worthy journalist. She went out and interviewed 100 victims of Jeffrey Epstein. That paper had no budget. And the case was closed. And this woman just made it happen. She's excellent, but she's also has this grit like, oh no, this is what I'm going to do. And there's women in that business, Jane Mayer, who I become friends with, where you always feel like I got to hook these two women up because women got to be together. You know, even if they're both like Jane's at the New Yorker but these guys, I just said, I know that these guys are going to be pals. So I hooked them up just like you and I, like there's something unspoken and thicker than I'd always, you know, because also you're funny and crazy. And also, what's going on with your friend that I, you know, that from my, what's her?
Oh, name? I told her I was speaking to you. She said, oh. Yes. We're a big fan. This is when Dave is like, don't say anything. Yeah. Don't use the name.
Oh, my God.
He's laughing.
She's great. She's the best. You're always there, though. That's the problem.
Excuse me. You both are. Excuse me. I was sitting there sometimes going, hello, I'm here. I'm at the table. And Tom, you're supposed to set me up with somebody. Don't you know anybody? And you're like, I'll talk to you later.
I go, nobody's good enough for you.
Oh, you, that's
what I'm saying for the sports world. I go, oh boy. But I've always thought that way. And I just remember the pictures from the last charity event we did, the Venice art thing. There we went, the assets coming to the photo room. Just really inappropriate.
Oh, so inappropriate.
So awesome. So awesome.
I'm definitely, you know, not the most appropriate person.
Oh, that's great.
I make a lot of mistakes.
We also raise money. We're there doing a good thing.
We have raised a lot of money together.
Yeah. And so, you are
the most charitable person I've ever met. You don't say no to it. It could be like a dog adoption at 6 p.m. at Costco in freaking Glendale, and you'll be like, yeah, I'll be there. And come in, you whirl around for about a good 20, 30 minutes. You're like, all right, Bonnie, you good? Okay. I'm out. I have a meeting in 10 minutes. Yeah. I gotta go. But like, you never say no to anything.
Yeah.
You're such a kind person.
I don't say no to you. That's for sure. And I do get a lot out of being of service. I think I have the opportunity to do things. I have a scholarship fund, give away 2 full rides every year to my old college, done it for 30. There's things that mean a lot to me. My heart camp, my children's heart camp. It's the biggest camp, Del Corzo, the biggest camp for kids with heart defects and heart disease in America. But also comes back to help me because, you know, if my kids ever needed a doctor, knock on wood, or when I had heart failure, you know, I these guys that stepped up for me, these brilliant cardiologists that we had. So it's selfish in a way because I get so much out of it. I enjoy the kids. I like to see them grow up. I like to see them become counselors. I like answering all their questions. And it's been one of the best things in my life. So I get a lot out of it.
You give back to so many people and you've had such an incredible life, man. Every time you're on Howard Stern, I can't get out of the car. I mean, you two together. I mean, he gets you to talk about everything.
Yeah. I'm going back in 2 weeks.
I'm no Howard Stern, but man, he'll get you to say anything. Well, not okay. that you have not that you have a filter, but let's.
No, but I think it's good, and that's why again I'm happy to be going back on. You know, because he kind of trimmed down his days.
Yeah,
he doesn't do. You know, when I first started going on there 30 some years ago, he ran and ran. He was on every day, and now he's being a little more pinpoint about what he does. He's still the best that ever.
Thank God he signed up for another 5 years, or I'd have to. Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to leave Los Angeles because I can't stand driving here.
Yeah,
but
I'll tell you something. He did once. So right after Roseanne and I broke divorced about a year or so, and I was staying at the Regency in New York, the hotel, and Gary called me, Baba Booey, and said, "Hey, Roseanne's on the show right now." And we'd had a very acrimonious divorce. She said,
you
I
did? Had oh, no, I never heard that.
She said, I had a 3-inch penis. And I said, even a 747 looks small for lands in the Grand Canyon. And we'd had this divorce. And he said, you know, she wants to make amends. And would you like to talk to you on the show? And I go, well, I'm up for that.
I remember.
I always am. I'm always trying to get to the other side of something or letting it happen. And I started talking, and then she was with this other guy, and they accused me of something. And then 45 minutes later, I'm standing on the bed. I realized, I'm like, you know, and it has, if you can still hear it on the show, it's crazy.
I have, by the way, crazy. I have heard this many times, and it went from zero to you guys. It was so bad. It was like, so I thought you were going to show up there and just, I mean,
Steve Tisch, who owns this family owns the hotel. The first call when I hung up, the phone rang, it was him. And he's like, are you okay? I go,
yeah.
Was that bad? And he's like, people are pulled off the side of the 405 freeway listening mm-hmm. to it.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Pre-serious days.
Yeah.
What do you think? What would you say like your biggest, like, because you've had so many setbacks and, you know, personal stuff and 4 divorces and all that. Like, what do you think, like, the biggest thing that caused you to, like, what was the biggest moment that you can remember that was a real watershed-like moment? Like, well, oh,
you know,
shit.
Hopefully you learn from everything. And I really don't consider my marriages. I don't consider that Howard Stern show a failure. That was so great.
It was great.
I wish it hadn't happened. But, you know, you look at all the other opportunities I've had in my life. And, you know, I certainly went into all 4 of my marriages like, this is it. I'm going to do my best. I'm not going to break the big rules. I'm going to have her back. Well, I assume we'll have each other's back. And things change. And at the end of each, you know, I was relieved, and because it whatever it was, and I may have jumped in, I definitely jumped into a couple at least too fast. Mm-hmm. And now I say, if you want to marry someone, divorce them first, and then see who they really are, and then marry them.
Listen, I'm just trying to could you just be quiet, because I literally he's sitting right here, like yeah. trying to pick a date. Let me just get a date before.
He's very stable, and he's
but
a father.
The divorce is, he's a great dad, but those aren't, I mean, that's not like a big fail. I never think of those as failures. I mean, if things don't work out, they don't work out, but like.
Well, they failed. They did fail. The enterprise of being married forever to one person, that failed 4 times, but I would like to have the money. I definitely, just from the weddings,
oh my God,
millions of dollars.
And the lawyer fees, Jesus.
Oh, they're the worst.
Do you think there's a number 5 out there for you, or you
don't? I'm not going to say no. Who knows what, you know, as James Cameron said after my divorce, he goes, I go, well, people are saying I should never, he goes, nobody writes your fucking story. Nobody writes the end of your fucking story. He's been married 5 times. That you write it. Tell those people to fuck off. You do whatever works for you.
Woohoo! I love hearing that. And that's also part of why I love you so much, because you're just that type of person that if you need a pep talk, Tom Arnold is the guy you should call.
Well, you know, I have to say too, not a lot of people are that interested in a 62-year-old single father with an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, because they basically got to be kind of the mirror of me. Or something where they're, you know, because the kids are so involved in my life. But that doesn't mean I don't want to hook up with people.
Well, let's say it now, ladies and gentlemen listening to this podcast, all 10 of you. The man is available. I have his number. It's his it's his fifth act. He's available.
I was engaged four other times before I started getting married. I'm a good long-term, sort of long-term guy. And I'm just sad that we never hooked up before you. You know, sometimes when you're so crazy with somebody, that you go, okay, well, I guess it's just us in the world because we're both so inappropriate, funny. Yes. You know,
I had to meet my person to figure me out and get me and stick with me. And it took me this long, but yes, it's, we are definitely different. We are different.
Dave McLean is lucky to be with you. You are fucking amazing. You're amazing. You're exciting. You're self-reflective. Your mother was strong, and that's how you go, well, my woman I'm married, what about her relationship with her mother? Okay, that's your mother's a badass, and you're so beautiful.
Oh.
And I think I've seen most of your body. You are just an amazing. I have seen all of your heart, and you're a survivor. And he is fucking lucky, and he knows it. He knows it. You're both lucky.
You're going to make me cry.
It's true.
Thank you. I try my best. Like you, I've make mistakes and it's just so good to talk to people like you because, you know how I beat myself up the survivors, all of us from childhood abuse, it's my fault. It's my fault. And, you just have to, that's part of this podcast. I just want people to know, you got to just get up and forgive yourself and start again and try to be better.
Yeah. Cause we've only got this one life. We've only got today. We all have it. People are like, how old are you? And I'd be like, I'm today old, motherfucker. That's all. And we've got today, and it's a gift. Now, if other people want to keep us back in that, that's fucking on them. But we have to be our best self today. Sure, we make mistakes. Sure, we do this. But this is our day. And this is our life. This one, I don't know what your religion is. I think this is heaven. This is it. To make the best we could do and be as kind to people and have as much love as we can. And the other stuff is bullshit. Once we have set straight things out within ourselves. The world changes when you work on yourself. You know that too.
Oh, yeah.
You're able to see things. But then there's just some people that are crap. You just got to ignore them.
And then you work on yourself and then you have a setback and then you're like, God damn it. And then you work on yourself more and then you'll have a setback. But I love the way you think. You are so inspiring.
Yeah. Well,
I love you.
Knock on wood. I love you. I love Dave. I think you guys are.
Do you want to roast our wedding?
No, I'm an ordained minister.
You are? Oh, what?
Nobody that I've married has ever broken up and they've all been gay. Gay couples. Oh, I'm 4 for 4 and 0 for 4 in marriages that I was in. So I'll do whatever I can do with you guys.
Thank you so much for coming on. I love you.
Thank you. Mwah. Love you. Love you.
Bye.
I know.
How good was that? God, I love that guy. I really, truly love that guy. You know, he's very polarizing. Which I love people that are like that. It's because he just really lives his life and he's so honest. I mean, he will tell you anything. And what he's overcome, check out that show, Queen of Meth. I think it's on AMC, but I'm going to watch it. I can't wait to watch it. I've seen some clips. It looks insane. And he's really done everything. I mean, everything from Christmas movies for kids in Rome to, you know, getting tons and tons of, let's say, extracurricular activities at unfortunate bathhouses next to LAX, to writing movies, to producing movies, to working with Arnold, to, my God, his Howard Stern interviews are always my favorite. Check that one out. It just came out last week, so it's on replay. He's so honest about his sobriety and everything he's been through, and he really inspires me a lot, and he's one of the most forgiving people that I've ever known. He started a meeting, an AA meeting that himself that's been going for 30 years here in Los Angeles. He's sponsored so many people. And no matter what happens, he always gets back up. Nothing knocks him down. And he always finds a second act or a second wife or a third or maybe a fourth. But he is truly one of my dear friends. He's been there for me throughout a lot of things that I've needed help in, especially recently and just in the past. And he's, every day's a new day. He's always positive, because I love that quote that he says, you write your own fucking story. Nobody else can write your fucking story. So if you don't like the way your act is going, rewrite it. And that's my advice to you today. Hope you enjoyed that one. Hope you had some laughs. Sending you all love. Don't forget to follow me again, second_act_podcast on Instagram. And Bonds Somerville is my own personal Instagram. Download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave me that review on Apple. Tell me how amazing I am. Tell me how beautiful I am. Tell me how, I don't know. Listen, I get them all. But, you know, getting nice ones, that would help. That would help a lot. So lots of love to you guys, and have a great day.